Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
I'm really glad I went to the gym today, humble brag, because I've just been sitting, working, and let me tell you, not as fun. There's a different energy of like when you're sitting and doing nothing or you're sitting and working on your computer, but you've worked out beforehand that you do feel like a little bit of a benefit. Okay. So Quinn, we're on the up and up. We're on the mend here. We're feeling better. And by we, I mean you are.
Yes. I'm feeling better. I'm feeling braver. I'm feeling stronger. I'm feeling
stronger than yesterday. Do you think that's what Britney Spears' song was about?
Having the flu.
Getting the flu and then a sinus infection right after.
Yeah, I have to remember to take my antibiotics, but so far so good. I think they're working. I'm surviving. I'm gonna make it. I'm a survivor. That's how Griff sings it. I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor.
I said, why
do you sing it that way? And he said, it's Spanish. And he said, do you want to know how to say no in Spanish? Because this is what being in a bilingual program has got, where that's gotten us. Do you want to know how to say no in Spanish? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, no. Ask him when he gets home. How do you say no in Spanish? No.
I really like him. I really like him.
So smart, that kid.
He makes me laugh so hard. And he controls the weather with his moods. He's kind of amazing. I think he's a superhero. I think he genuinely is a superhero. I was telling Quinn, I went and saw my first apartment of the apartment hunt of 2025 yesterday. Mm-hmm. And the theme, too expensive, too small, is right on track. And then Quinn and I were reminiscing about when we went and visited a murder house. And
Gary went to go look at an apartment and I went with her, and it was so scary that we were laughing so hard we were crying. Like, there was like a dead body falling out of the wall. We were like, we gotta get out of here.
They're like, that'll be fixed. That'll be fixed.
And we were like, what? Why is this listed right now? Are you guys nuts?
New York, it moves fast. The best is the guy that I saw. I think the great thing is I got a notification for the place yesterday and it's already in contract. And the guy, he told me, I think his name here, I'm not kidding you, and this is not right, but I feel like his name was Israel Keys. It's not. His name was Israel something, and maybe that's why subconsciously I was like, I gotta get out of here. This is not it. I actually liked the location of it.
Where was it?
But it was off the Park Place S. Mm-hmm. So it was like right there in Crown Heights, Prospect Heights.
I like that too.
Like, I like that
area.
Really
good restaurants.
Really good restaurants. Great area. I've lived around there before. And it's also like, was nice to come from here to there and be like 20 minutes, easy train. Like, I liked that. That being said, I walked in and I was like, well, the good news is it looks like the listing photos, and it was like new stuff, but there was just like one tiny closet in the small space. And I was like, that feels like, you're going to want more. You're going to want more than that. Mm-hmm. And then,
oh my God, can I tell you that we used to live in a place that didn't have closets? Like our condo that we lived in before this didn't have closets. And so like there was like a weird IKEA wardrobe that the people that lived there before left behind. And like we did end up like building a closet upstairs.
Yeah.
But the guy that lives there now, I got a bathing suit delivered to him the other day. Normal
the other
thing to
day
do. Old Navy forgot that I moved, or I forgot to tell them, and I was like, just on
it was
old
definitely
Navy.
Old Navy's fault. It was definitely Old Navy's fault.
It was for sure. And they were like, so I signed on, and then I just like shipped this clearance swimsuit to him. very awkward. And then we had to write him and be like, I shipped a swimsuit to you. Can I come pick it up? And he's like, yeah, I'll buzz you in even though I'm not in the country. And I was like, that's fancy. So I came over and he buzzed me in and I couldn't, and I had to search the whole building because whoever, like somebody brought it all the way up to the apartment, like a nice neighbor or something, like brought it up. Anyway, I went right outside this person's apartment and took the swimsuit. The point is, he was so excited because he was like, hey, do you guys want to see a video of what it looks like now? And we were like, yes. And he sent us a video and he, I can tell why he was excited. It's because he did the work himself, but he created built-ins everywhere. Like built-ins where it was a really tall ceilinged apartment, and he created like a book, one of those bookshelves that's all over a wall that has one of those rolly ladders. It was sick. And then
that's very cool.
The big bedroom downstairs, we slept in the loft, which was open to the rest of the apartment, but there was one room with a door and it was just a big room. And that's the one that had the shitty IKEA wardrobe in it. That one, he did built-ins in, and it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, where I was like, you transformed the space in a way where it's going to be so, you could charge so much now if you sell it. It looked so insanely good.
I was so like, want to see it because I remember your old place.
But it changed everything. It's just the idea that, if you know what you're doing, you can transform. Form a space like it
totally.
It was such a game changer. It looked so unbelievably good.
I don't know if one would do that for a place they're renting.
Certainly
is
not.
It's kind of the deal. The thing is what I learned about it is it did look like the listing, and the guy also goes. But also, I learned that I don't have great depth perception in photos. That's what I've learned because it was like I don't know if it was. It was fine. It also had a lot of it was basically all new. And I was like, that doesn't feel as important to me as, you know, because I think I can fix, you can paint things, you can fix things. I don't think new stainless steel appliances isn't what is exciting to me about an apartment. And if I'm paying more for that, that's not what I want to be paying for.
Right.
Jordan, our friend, was like, you should just start looking. And I was like, okay. So I've been emailing people and trying to get appointments and stuff, which is also like, it's such a crazy thing in New York because he's like, this will be off the market tonight. And it's like so, it's such true. An aggressive, it's so aggressive.
Yeah, it does make you uncomfortable. You know what? I really recommend you to join the neighborhood group here on Facebook because so many people don't use an agent. They just post. And it's a really good way of seeing something when it's like not formally on the market.
Okay. I will absolutely do that. I love that. All right, cool. Done. Because I would like to keep going to the gym.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to do too.
It's so fun, right?
It's really fun. I mean, it was so great. The other day I was walking and I ran into someone who I met in LA like 2 years ago when I was there visiting for a friend's birthday. And she just moved on she moved right down the block. I won't say where you live. She moved right down the block. And so we're going to grab a drink or something and visit a neighborhood haunt tomorrow night.
Fun.
Which I'm excited about because she's like another single gal. We're going to figure it out. We'll go to a little bar and I'll connect. And the thing is, she's a producer. She grew up here. She's from LA. Like, I'm excited to hang out and meet a new friend.
Yeah. Don't forget.
Really good.
The other big news in my life is that my sister just had an emergency C-section.
And
they pulled two babies out of her. Both boys. Identical twins, you might call them.
It's very exciting. I saw pictures of them.
They're the cutest babies in the world because they're unencumbered by the vaginal canal. They're just got lifted out in their perfect form. Yeah. With their beautiful faces, because she was going to die if they didn't do that. It was highly stressful for
everyone. Can you say what the doctor said? Because I really liked this.
The doctor said to her, I think that Brianna was saying something about, I just want the babies, blah, 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 blah. I don't know what she was asking. And then the doctor said, well, I just want your husband to have a wife while he's raising them.
And that's you what know I'm what thinking I like, about. I really, you know, sometimes perspective is a beneficial thing. We like it. We like perspective. It's good for us. But I'm so glad she's okay. I'm so glad the babies are okay.
Me too.
Are okay. They're so cute. And also, I'm so stoked that it's like all of your little boy kid. Like, there's not a girl.
Koa's army gets stronger.
Koa's army is going to defeat us all. So it's funny. It's like four gals, four daughters have.
And between us, six grandsons for my parents.
Yeah.
Six grandbaby boys. We just make boy babies only, it turns out.
It's boy babies or bust.
Boy babies or bust, but I think that they're going to have so much fun all together. It's going to be like a very cute extended family Thanksgiving with like 100 gentlemen at the table.
And it's great.
As Ko would say, kind of about himself.
Yeah, kind of. But he's the firstborn, so I think he's got to be the trailblazer. And I feel really stoked. I think he's a really good role model, and he's a really good oldest. And it sounds like I was over at Jordan's house, and apparently, because she was like, Koa is so nice to Frida. She was bragging, she was just speaking so kindly about how sweet Koa is. And apparently, at one point, he was building magna tiles, and Frida came and knocked it over. And apparently, Koa was like, what happened? And then somebody was like, well, those were Frida knocked it over. And he was like, I love it. It's amazing. Immediately being like, Frida, it's beautiful.
You did such a good job knocking that down, Frida.
Yeah, it was something like that. But I actually just really enjoyed that he has such a profound sense of
taking care of people.
We gotta take care of these little babies.
He takes care of me, which I'm always like, is this therapeutically a good idea? But he can't help himself. He's constantly checking in on me and being like, you okay? Do you have a good day? pets my back. Like, he was rubbing my back when I was putting him to bed the other night, and he was like, is this good? And it's like really bad, but you're like, yeah, that's nice.
The effort. I like the energy. I like the energy and the effort.
He's the sweetest little person. I just love his heart.
Well, congratulations to the Posner clan on the two new additions.
Killing it.
Huge news.
Absolutely.
And also
killing it. Getting enormous.
Getting absolutely ginormous. Two babies at a time at this point. By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily. Let's I'm Carrie Ibama.
I'm Quinlan Posner. Let's do some stuff. Quit bragging.
Stop bragging about your damn name.
Stop. Enough's
just
enough.
Quit it. Enough is enough. You go
Should
first.
We do stories. Okay. All right. This story is from People, Wikipedia, ABC, and an amazing 2020 episode with Diane Sawyer titled Escape from a House of Horror. This is the Turpin family.
No, no, no. Oh, God. I love this story. I'm sorry. Is it Jordan, who's this daughter?
Yeah.
I love her so much.
Everyone loves
heart,
Jordan. Jordan's everyone's. Yeah.
My heart breaks for Jordan. Everyone's hero. I've wanted to cover this case, but I just haven't because I'm like, it's so much.
It's so much. She's so great.
Love
if you guys haven't seen this 2020, I watched it when it first came out because everyone did. And then I remembered it the other day and was like, I got to cover this because what a story.
Yeah.
It starts with a security camera on the street picking up somebody climbing out a window and walking very unsure, like turning one way and then being like, nope, and then like walking the other way. This is Jordan Turpin. And we're in Paris, California. She calls 911 as soon as she's a little bit away from the house. And what strikes the woman that picks up the call, that she has a very stilted way of speaking. And that the woman's like, what street are you on? And she doesn't know. And she says, I live in a family of 15, okay? Can you hear me? And she keeps being like, can you hear me? Okay. And she's very sweet. She's very
polite.
Polite and innocent sounding, and has the voice of a much younger child. She's actually 17 years old. And she says, we have abusing parents. Did you hear that? They hit us. They throw us across the room. They yank out our hair. My two little sisters right now are chained up. And so she's talking to her, and the woman will be like, are you still there? And she'll be like, oh, yeah. Oh, I'm still here. And she's like so sweet. And she says that at the time her whole body was just shaking. She could barely dial the phone. She was so terrified. And she points out that part of her fear was that she'd never talked really to strangers, and she'd certainly never dialed a phone and talked to someone on the other end of it before. And when the woman is trying to get the address from her, which is very important because she has all this information, Jordan is saying, I don't know. I can't. She says, it's going to take me a while. I've never been out. I don't understand the streets or anything. The woman's trying to get her to read street signs, and she's like, I'm at a stop sign. So she has her stay there. The deputies that are called are 14 minutes away. She's standing in the road. She doesn't totally understand the utility of a sidewalk. She then starts to rattle off just a list of a ton of numbers and is like, that's my address. And the woman's like, no, that's definitely not your address. She's probably reading like the number, serial numbers on a sign, something. But they figure out where she is. She's terrified. She says that her parents will kill her if they find out she got out. But she wants to help her sisters. She says, I live in filth. Sometimes I wake up and I can't breathe. We never take baths. And the woman asked, when's the last time you bathed? And she said, I don't know, maybe a year ago. They said, do your parents have weapons? She says she thinks her dad's had a gun. She's never seen it, but she's heard him talk about it. She calls her parents mother and father. And she says, mother doesn't like us. She doesn't spend time with us. The woman asks, does anyone take do you take medication? And she says, I don't know what that is. And the woman says, medicine. And she says, if we have a cold, sometimes we take Robitussin. And the woman's like, okay, who else is in the house? And she is like, my siblings that are 2, 11, 12, 14, 16, I'm 17, 18, 19, 20, 22, 23, 25, and 29. Holy shit, 13 children in that house. The oldest is 29, the youngest is 2. Now we switch over to being able to see all this from the perspective of the body cam footage of the deputies that arrive. She says she's totally overwhelmed by talking to this person. He's very tall and very serious, is what she says. And she's explaining to him that her mom has chained up her siblings because they stole mother's food. The guy's like, are you on medication? It's not the first time she gets asked this. There's an effect here, the way she speaks, that is so unusual, I think, that they're like, is this person medicated? Because she's also really almost cheerful sounding. And it's such a strange circumstance to have that affect that they're like, what's going on? And again, she says she doesn't know what medication is. And he says, like, pills? And she says, no, I don't think I've ever taken any pills before. This guy's just not sure what to think about this. But she keeps explaining she's not used to talking to a stranger. And then he asks her, do you have proof that this is what's happening? And she's really excited when he asks this because she does. And she has pictures on the phone that she brought of her siblings chained up. And they're very malnourished, very dirty in these pictures. They have these very skinny, bruised arms. He asks her if she's hurt. She says, oh, no, not right now. She can't spell her name. As she waits in his car, she ends up showing him another video, and it's a video of her singing a song that the lyrics are like, you blame me for everything. I don't understand. They pull up to her house. It's now been half an hour since she's escaped. She's very scared. She stays in the car. He's like, do you want to come with us? She's like, absolutely not. Because she says she thinks they would even kill her in front of the police. So she stays in the car. They knock for a very long time. Nobody comes to the door for 2.5 minutes. And then when the parents do come out, they look scared. Like their eyes are wide and they're breathing heavily. It's this vibe of they've been caught. I mean,
I just like, I can't, I know what's come. I'm just like thinking about her and like, I'm so struck by her bravery. I just can't even, describe how it's just.
The parents are David Turpin, who was a shy kid with a stutter. He went to Virginia Tech. He was really smart. He got a very well-paid job at Lockheed Martin. The mom is Louise Robinette. And she was in Bible club. She sang. And they got married when she was 16 years old. They're both Pentecostal people that are super religious. And God told them to have as many kids as they could. So they really took that to heart. And they have 13 children. They start living in Fort Worth, Texas. And one of the kids that's come forward and is willing to talk about this experience growing up in this home is the eldest, Jennifer. And she talks about growing up, she had, it's like they didn't get as crazy as things got right away. She went to school and stuff. I think through third grade, she went to school, but she was picked on. She was neglected. It was the idea that kids were like, don't go near her. Like, and looking back, she's like, yeah, I probably dressed crazy and smelled really bad and behaved strangely. I was in a really strange situation, a strange home. My dad was abusive toward my mom. He would yell at her. He would punch walls. My mom, I think, was mentally ill, but I don't know. They used the Bible to explain why they hurt us, and they would beat us. They would put us in kennels. They would hit us with belt sticks. Eventually, they really didn't want to be parents, and there was a bunch of us. They moved us to a trailer out behind the house, and they'd leave groceries for us every week, but they'd just go live in a motel and do whatever they wanted. They were just away from us, not interested in being parents, and we didn't have enough food to make it work. So Jordan remembers from this time eating leaves and grass and mustard and ice. And Jennifer was tasked with putting the kids in cages if they misbehaved, because that's all she knew and that's what her parents had told her to do. And there was definitely a culture of do what we say or you're the one getting hurt. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what she was doing, and 3 years go by like this and nobody notices. The parents all the while will take all the kids out in public very rarely. And when they do, it is such a treat for these kids that they're thrilled to be out, that they will do exactly as they're told, which is to act the part. It's like, family. And they don't know if that's true or not. Like, they're kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's videos of them getting taken to this vow renewal in Las Vegas that the parents do, and they're all wearing matching clothes and swaying in the background and singing. And their arms are skinny as hell. Like, it looks like you're like, these kids are starving. And they have dark circles under their eyes, but they have these haunting sort of go along with it smiles. And it's not that the parents didn't have money at the time. They weren't, you know, think like 13 kids, maybe they're just poor, but they've got like vanity plates on their cars. Not that that costs a bunch, but it's, they're treating themselves much better than they're treating.
They're doing a vow renewal, and they bought their kids matching, and it wasn't for the kids' benefit. It was so that they could have a picture with everybody in matching outfits.
And these outfits are pretty and new and clean, and the kids are so excited to get to put them on. But then when they go home, they're told to take them off and put back on their dirty clothes. And we say dirty, oh God, these clothes had never been laundered. And it's like they'd give each kid like an outfit or two, maybe at the max, and they'd just wear it and be covered in filth. The smell, they talk about the smell like permeating the house and permeating their bodies. They moved to Paris, California. David's an engineer. They should, by all accounts, have enough money to have a good life. They have a nice house, two cars. But Louise does have a mental illness. I'm not totally clear on what it is. She'll be diagnosed with histrionic personality disorder, which is just so selfish. And she breaks up huge credit card debt. And it's so weird what she spends the money on. She buys kids' clothes and toys, but she doesn't let her kids have it, and they just sit in boxes. So the house is filled. Imagine like the scene is like that the kids are in clothes covered in dirt that smell, and their closets have clothes hung up with tags on them, brand new, but they're not allowed to put them on. Ditto the toys. It's not like a happy home where all the kids are playing with toys, but there's mountains of wrapped toys on the floor. David has to file for bankruptcy because of this really wild spending. And the kids are just eating bread and peanut butter. But the parents are eating somewhat normally. They're getting fast food and frozen dinners and stuff for themselves. It's not fancy, but they're feeding themselves what they want to eat. And their kids are eating like left barely to starve scraping for themselves. By.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to stand. They're not supposed to stand up in the house because they don't want anyone to see them. So they spend a lot of the day sitting on the floor, or the windows have like curtains drawn in most of the rooms. And there's three bedrooms the kids are dispersed in that are all like three bunk beds a bedroom, all of them equipped with chains. And they register as a homeschool and no one checks,
ever checks
on that. They somehow do get their hands on some smartphones. The older kids do, because they've been psychologically abused to a point where that's not actually a danger. These older kids have been abused to a point where they're almost 30 and they're just compliant. Yeah, they're in the house and they do exactly as they're told because they don't want to be punished. And I don't know that it occurs to them that there's another option. When you're raised in a house like that, we've seen that so many times. It's not even Stockholm syndrome. It's something else. It's just the idea that you don't believe in options at a certain point in the abuse cycle. They do watch TV sometimes, which helps them to learn the language because they're not being taught how to read or write. I'm 17 and she doesn't know how to spell her name. They are told not to speak to strangers when they're taken out. And they're told that if they do, they could get taken away. And to them, that's very scary because the thought was we would get dispersed away from each other. And we don't know where we would go. But the parents have them memorize what grade they're in so that if they're asked, it's like, oh, I know what grade I'm supposed to be in.
I mean, I'm sure their parents instilled fear on the outside and the others of everything. So not only that, they're like, what is leaving?
Right.
You know, yeah. The world is so scary. If you think this is bad, the world is worse.
If the story's not weird enough, the thing that like gives Jordan hope and changes her is Justin Bieber. He's the hero of the story, really, where she starts watching his videos and she's like, look at this guy. What a great life. What a fun life. And look at these people in his music videos and the fun they're having. And he has that magic. He does, you know? He has that
she's a believer
magic, the way like New Kids on the Block did, where it doesn't matter who you are or how you grew up. You know that this is where you want to be and who you want to be with. You're like, yes, Justin Bieber, yes. So that gets her thinking about leaving, believe it or not. Ann Sawyer's interviewing this girl and she's like, so what really changed things for you was Justin Bieber. And Jordan goes, oh no, I never talked to him. Diane Sawyer goes, no, I know. Just watching him though. And Jordan's like, oh yeah, yes.
Oh my God, I love her.
And she says when she saw him, and this is a direct quote from my girl Jordan, when she saw him, she was blow-minded. I love that.
She's such a special person, Jordan. She's truly magic.
Your whole heart like grows watching this girl. So she talks about how she wanted to like post videos of herself singing and she wanted to become a singer. And that's where the song comes from, the You Blame Me for Everything song that she sings. She used to like sneak when her parents were out and go film herself, make her own music videos. And she also was a way of reaching out to the outside world because she'd post them on YouTube and she'd get likes and she'd feel connected to the world. But people would write in the YouTube videos, it's weird, all the videos you post are dark and inside and do you ever go outside? And people are noticing.
I didn't realize she was posting them on Facebook and YouTube. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Neither did her parents. So the kids that get tied up, the origin story of that is that there was a time when they were starving and took food from the fridge. And remember, the food's just for the parents. So as a punishment, they used rope to tie up the kids. And then one of the kids used their teeth to bite through the rope. And that's when the parents deemed it necessary to get chains. And they would chain kids for months at a time sometimes and only release them to use the bathroom and then chain them again. And they talk about these kids had like lice and both their hands would be chained. They couldn't even itch their heads. Jennifer did try to escape at one point and it was too overwhelming for her and she came back. So she's been outside the house before and she draws this primitive map for Jordan. But she's too scared to go. But it's interesting because she does end up being like, we see on video that after Jordan escapes, just something happens where I think Jennifer's like, I want to help her and come too. And she leaves the house, goes the opposite way Jordan went. And then we see her go back and climb back into the window. I really feel this sense of what Jennifer was going through and it being like, I want to not be in this and I don't know how. And I'm so scared.
Yeah.
And Jordan is just going to be Justin Bieber. I'm getting the fuck out of here and I'm going to help my siblings. At one point, the kids before this escape attempt call a taxi to ask how much it would cost to drive to Nevada. And then they're like, it's a couple $100. And then Jordan goes, okay, what do I say now? And they're like, don't order it. And she goes, that's okay. I'm going to take a bus. Hangs up.
It's like, her, oh God. God.
Because Jordan has seen cops. That's how she knew she should get pictures to prove what was going on in her house. So she makes her bed in this way where it looks like she's still in the bed. She finds some clean clothes because she's like, I'm going to put on these clean clothes and try to
look nice.
Yeah, look a little more presentable.
For proof. And
so now we're back at the house and they're trying to get in and they're saying, oh, just so you know, we're packing to move, which is true. They were about to move to Oklahoma, which was what lit a fire under Jordan's ass, is that she was like, they had said something like, when we move to Oklahoma, everyone's going to get put in chains. And Jordan's like, this is the most freedom. It's only going to get worse. This is my chance.
Oh my God.
They say, do you have any weapons? The guy says, yes. David says, I have a gun. But it's locked away. And they're like, okay, they come in, moldy food everywhere, layers of trash on the floor. You can't see the floor. It's not a mess because they're packing. It's a mess in a very scary way. You see these unopened toys everywhere. The house is a total hoarder palace. It's a disaster and it smells. And Louise is trying to follow the police officers and prevent them from seeing more. She's trying for control, but they sequester her and David so that they can walk around the house. And they find these children. They're no longer chained. They're covered in dirt. They are bruised. They have skinny arms. They're quiet. They're scared. It doesn't look okay, but then they find a bedroom that has boxes in front of it. And they're like, is someone in there? And they're like, yeah, more kids. They go in and they do find a little boy chained to his bed by his wrists and by his ankles. So then in the other room, the deputies ask the kids that are in there, where do they keep the chains? The kids are really scared, but show them there are chains in the closet. At this point, they're able to cuff the parents and take them out of the house. They're under arrest. They need to find the lock to let the little boy out. And so they're asking the kids and they're like, oh, that's in mother and father's room in the drawer. They go in that room. There's a pack and play with a 2-year-old in it, waving them, smiling. And the room is no different than the other rooms, just covered in garbage. I mean, truly, mental illness has to be a part of this story.
I don't think anyone could think that this is, there's no way. There's no way. There's no way.
Yeah, I also say that, though, because one of the lead detectives was like, almost implying that it wasn't, like being like, some people are just bad. And it's like, yes, I agree. This was pure evil, but it's coupled with pure evil, mental illness, you can't have a house like that and be well. All the kids are taken to the hospital and they have atrophied muscles. They're starving. They're bruised. And at this point, they are trying to figure out what happened with these parents. And that's when they diagnose Louise with histrionic personality disorder. And she's writing letters about getting her kids back and being like, I'm not going to do the chains this time. Her sister comes forward, not in her defense per se, but she does have another piece of the puzzle, which is that when they were young, they were both sexually abused by a family member throughout their childhood. David doesn't really give an answer for why he did what he did. They're both very apologetic when they're in court. They both plead guilty on all the counts. They cry. They read letters from their kids that a lot of their kids wrote them to say, just so you know, I forgive you. The oldest son in court talks about how now he's learned how to ride a bike, learned how to swim, gotten his bachelor's degree. I mean, this is a kid in his late 20s and he's learning all this stuff now. And he says, I'm learning how to eat healthy and prepare my own meals. Jennifer talks in court and says, my parents took my whole life from me, but I'm not going to let them change me. I'm strong. And she talks to Diane Sawyer about, I want the Turpin name to be associated with strength and I want to be strong.
Yeah. Yeah.
When the parents talk about it, they are like, we love our children. We think they love us and we miss them and we're sorry. We really are sorry. And Jordan is like, I feel bad when I see them cry. And I know that they must have not had a good childhood to do this, but they always had a choice and they chose to do this to us.
Yeah. These kids are like so, it's such a, to me, it's like such a lesson in the perseverance of the human spirit that these like little kids, like they weren't taught any of this, and yet they are persisting. Like that to me is just like, it's so weird of it to me.
Yeah. A lot of times we just watched this experiment in class called the Bobo experiment, where there's like a doll and adult is like beating up the doll and hurting it, and then you watch like the kid has an opportunity to play with the doll and then they play with it the same way. They like are super violent. And it's showing you the cycle of domestic violence basically. But it's so strange because the sense you get when you hear from these kids is not that they're gonna re-perpetrate violence. There's something about them that's so Justin Bieber vibes, where they're all like, we just want to sing. We just want to dance in the sunlight. And I believe them. I'm like, how did this is a miracle. I mean, like whatever happened that preserved you and your goodness through this is amazing.
Now, to be clear, I agree that people we've heard from, but there are 13 kids and I don't think we've heard from all 13.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Kids.
You're like, right. I think most of the kids did not want to appear on this special and their identities are protected.
Yeah, and as they should be.
We hear from Jennifer, the eldest. We hear from the eldest son without seeing his face, but we do hear from him. And we hear from Jordan, who is a fucking ray of sunshine.
The fact that Jordan even they dared to get free is miraculous, beyond miraculous.
She's so brave. And now the story pivots where they're like, these kids are going to have an opportunity to have a good life and we have to right the wrongs. We have to make it better. And California needs to figure out what to do with these kids to give them the lives that they deserve. And what ends up happening is that when 2020 goes to investigate what's happened, they're like, oh my God, the older kids are like homeless. They're living in squalor. There's been money set aside. There was private donations for them, for their education and for their homes, for their lives. And it got put in an account that's protected and they have to go see somebody to ask for money from it. And it never gets granted. We're like, the eldest will be like, I need a bike. And they'll be like, no. And it's like thousands and thousands of dollars. And it's all been kept quiet. Nobody talks about it. Nobody behaves in a way that's like responsible when questioned about it. And these kids are having to go to churches to get food. They're couch surfing.
It's the
same. No one's helping them figure out healthcare. No one's helping them figure out a world that they do not know. They were not exposed to. One of the adult kids gets assaulted in a home. They talk about how because they were in this house and they just don't know better, they were raised feral, they don't have a sixth sense. So they're walking around the world without these like emotional protections. Yeah. And it's, they don't know what to do. Jordan gets released from foster care very suddenly. And she's like, I don't know what I'll do because no one's helping me figure out how to get a job or like how to get on a bus or how to go to a dentist. And I've never done anything like that in my whole life.
And they're
all
separated.
Joshua is the 29-year-old. And he talks about, or he's 29 at the time of this interview. 2020 episode. And he talks about like how he couldn't get any of that money to help him. And the craziest thing is one of these kids is in a foster home and the mom tells the kid that she understands why her parents chained her up.
Oh my God.
But and that like, is not the most egregious form of abuse that happens. In April 2018, six of the Turpin children are placed under the foster care of the Olguin family. And in 2021, they start to investigate this family because there were all kinds of horrible things happening in the home. There were 9 victims. It wasn't just the Turpin children, but they were forcing the siblings of the Turpin home to participate in what they call circle confession talk, like forcing them to sit and talk about their past traumas in a way that was horrible and traumatic for them. They are keeping them in their rooms just like they were before, and they put wind chimes on the doors so they can hear when the kids leave and they can confront them. And the father in the household, Marcelino Olguin, is accused of sexually touching a bunch of the children in the home, and he pleads guilty to lewd acts on a child, false imprisonment, and injuring a child. And his wife and his adult daughter plead guilty to child cruelty, because it seems like he gets sentenced to 7 years in a state prison. And one of the kids that was part of the Turpin family that was in that home says, "All I wanted was to finally have a loving family and recover from my trauma. But unfortunately, I did not receive that." Four of the six Turpin kids were living there at the time he was arrested. So four were still in the home at the time he was arrested for sexually abusing children in the house. The woman that was tasked with caring, basically the oversight, the caseworker, yeah. Vanessa Espinosa, she won't help teach them anything. And when they ask her things like, "How do I get medical benefits?" she'll say, "Go Google it." And she has a real estate business on the side that she posts videos for. And you just get that feeling of this was a job she did not care about or take seriously. And she wasn't held accountable at all for not doing her job. And then 2020 starts following her around to be like, "Fuck you. Why aren't you doing your job?" And then the county calls 2020 to be like, "She doesn't work for us anymore." And it's not clear if they got word she wasn't doing her job and fired her, or if she was like, "This job ain't worth the racket. 2020 is following me. I'm out." Not clear. But again, nobody has to answer for this crime of not protecting these kids and making sure that they were okay after this horrible thing happened to them. And all these elected officials are just dodging 2020 when they're trying to get any sort of information, and or people are saying, "We're really happy with the job our agency has done," and you're like, "What?" Just lying.
This young woman, these two young women, I'm going to give Jordan and Jennifer credit for their harrowing escape. And it's obviously in these human interest stories, you'd like to go, "Oh gosh, they're safe, they did it." And it's that is just the beginning. They have a whole life of recovery. And it's that's I really love the show.
I think most of us read the article when the parents were arrested.
They're safe.
And everybody just had this "Thank God they're out of there." And it's so wild that the story absolutely didn't end there. And it still hasn't ended. And ABC is suing to unseal documents because they're this needs to out.
It's this and family. Oh God.
The four youngest children are still in foster care right now. And the nine older children are in the world trying to figure out how to fucking be a part of it. And the only ones we really know about, because the only ones that will come forward and talk about what they're going through, are Jordan and Jennifer. And Jennifer's training to be a manager at a restaurant as of the 2020 episode. She wants to be a Christian pop star. And Jordan's really into making TikToks. She did graduate from TikToks. High school. She's on food stamps. She's getting housing through school because she's a student. So we have this sense that these girls are tough. They're going to make it. They're survivors. There was a really amazing article that was about a kid that went to school with Jennifer. And he wrote this article about it where he was like, "When I saw the Turpin stuff come out, I realized, wait a minute, I went to school with Jennifer Turpin when she was a kid." And he talks about how no matter what, you didn't want to get caught sitting next to her or talking to her. And he talks about the guilt that they should all carry from those days. And he's like, talk to the Jennifer Turpins in your life. You don't know what goes on behind closed doors.
And tell your kids.
If there's a kid that's being quiet or weird or off, there could be a lot of reasons for it. And they need help and they need friends and they need love. And we have to give it to them.
And I don't want to blame the teachers or anything, but I'm also how could they not have seen?
That's the feeling you get. Talk about, why didn't the neighbors think? They were let down so many times. They're like, hold up, why didn't the neighbors think this was weird? Imagine seeing us all leave even once to go to the wedding or whatever, and then never seeing us again and seeing shadows go by the wind. It's just what's this family doing with their kids? Why isn't anyone calling Child Protective Services? why isn't anyone checking up on this woman that registered to homeschool all her kids? Why aren't you seeing what the homeschool looks like? Because there are a lot of rules around that. You get sent money to homeschool.
Yeah.
I mean, and if the government was sending her money willy-nilly, but now they won't even give the kids the money they're owed, it's so bizarre. And it feels like this, these private donations got stolen. It feels like somebody else like took advantage of these kids after everything else they've been through. It just feels like, where is Mr. Rogers right now? Where are the fucking helpers? Get out from under the rock, helpers, and help. And that's the story of the Turpins. I'm sorry, it's not very happy.
No. Okay. I watched an episode of Social Media Murders. So, spoiler alert, that's what I watched. I got this also from BBC. I want to introduce you to Alexander Rhoda. He's 15 years old. He lives in Ashley, Cheshire. And this episode was amazing because, one, everybody had incredible English accents. And there was some really, that just sounded amazing. And it's near Manchester. So their accents are also very cool. Now, Alex, from a young age, his mom is interviewed, and she knew from a young age that he was a more feminine kid. And at 13 years old, he told his mom he needed to tell her something, and she knew right away. He came out, and it seems like this kid was just totally comfortable in his skin. He was a 15-year-old in 2019, so the kid was, like, fully into social media. His phone was permanently attached to his hand. He was constantly posting videos of him and his friends dancing and singing. His dad, when he came out, he was just worried that his son would experience homophobia. And Alex was bullied, but he had this amazing group of girlfriends. Like, all of these young girls are interviewed who knew and love Alex, and they just talk about how he was funny and he just was like the life of the party. He was a really good guy. He was 6'2". He was a bigger kid, and he's great. And he's 15 years old, and it's November of 2019, and he's very excited because he's talking to a boy online, and he tells one of his friends who's older, a couple years older, he was in your year. His name is Matt Mason, and he's never had a relationship before, but he's showing his friends all these flirty texts that he's getting from Matt Mason, and his friends are, that's surprising. I did not know he was attracted to men, but Matt Kemp comes from a wealthy family. In the documentary, they say his family are farmers, so I think they're pretty well off. But he was an odd character. One of the girls talks about how in school he had a bit of a temper, and she remembers him, like, clenching his fists and lashing out. Matt had left school at that point, so the mere connection was just social media. They were communicating via Instagram and via Snapchat, and Matt started sending pretty explicit images to Alex, sending him, like, dick pics, videos of him masturbating via Snapchat. And there was a forensic psychologist who talks about how this escalates the relationship because Matt has this sense that Snapchat, it deletes right away. But Alex is pretty savvy, and so he's saving them. And it's escalating pretty quickly, and he's sending him these videos like one a day. Now, Alex is 15. He is underage, and this is all very new. And it's November, and he's talking to Alex, and they haven't met in real life, I don't think, yet. But he finds out that Matt has a girlfriend, and Alex is pissed. And so he reaches out to Matt, and he's like, listen, I'm going to have to tell your girlfriend that you're messaging me. I don't want to see you if you have a girlfriend. And Matt's like, please don't message her. When Alex gives him a deadline, and Matt does not adhere to it, Alex reaches out to his girlfriend, and he's like, he's been sending me text messages. And then Matt reaches out to Alex and is like, how could you do that? He's very upset. Mm-hmm. And Matt is able to convince his girlfriend that it's just a lie. And so Alex is like, well, I have proof. And it's at that point that Matt starts to offer Alex money for his silence. Now, he's sending him money and he's showing his friends all of this. And it gets to over 2,000 pounds that this 19-year-old is sending this 15-year-old for his silence. Alex's mom, Lisa, she recalls coming home in early December and she tries to open her front door and the door is locked. And she sees brown work boots mm-hmm. in the front and she manages to go inside and she goes upstairs and she sees Matt leaving and Alex is like, oh, this is just my friend. And she's like, okay, he can leave. And she remembers her blink going off around this kid. And she remembers telling her son, stay away from that boy. There's something not right about him, Alex. She wants her son to be free, but I think she sensed that this guy is not comfortable in his own skin and he's hiding mm-hmm. and he's older. And she's like, I just don't feel good about this. Mm-hmm. It's December 12th, 2019. And Alex is about to go out and he tells his mom that his friend, Georgie, she's going to pick him up. And they're going to go out to dinner, but that's not the plan. He tells his friends the plan. He's very close with his friends. And so he tells his friends, he's like, guys, this is very exciting. Matt Mason is going to take me out to dinner and we're going to go out for a meal. But he said before that, he wants to take me to this special place, a field near a forest. Mm-hmm. And his girlfriends are like, okay.
Near a forest, fuck.
Please don't go to a field with this guy. And he's like, no, it's fine. He's going to pick me up at like 5:45 and he's FaceTiming his friends. He's very excited. And they're like, what's so special about a field? Like, please don't go. It's not a good idea. It's a field. And so he goes. And while he's out, he posts around 6:00. He posts to his close friends in his story a picture inside a car. And so mm-hmm. with two little hearts on it. So we'll flash forward to 9:00 that night. His mom leaves the restaurant I believe she works at, or it's just she leaves the restaurant. She was out to dinner. It wasn't clear, but she leaves and she goes to call Alex and he doesn't answer. And that's not totally uncommon. It'll go to voicemail. He's out with his friends. It's not that big of a deal, but he doesn't answer the phone. And so she comes home and he's not there. And so she's like, that's weird. So she starts calling his friends, including Georgia, who he's supposed to be out with. And she's like, hey, where's Alex? He's not here. Is he with you? And she's like, what are you talking about? He's like, no, he's supposed to be with you, right? And she's like, no, he's going out with Matt Mason. And so when Lisa hears that, she starts to panic. She knows something is very, very wrong. And she gets all of his friends to come to her house and all these young girls come. And they start to post things on Facebook, which will eventually get shared over 200,000 times.
Oh, my God.
And it's at that point where they start to share, and I guess because he was on social media, people knew him as far as Liverpool in Manchester proper. He's from the suburb, a little outside of Manchester, mm-hmm. but people start to know him. So they start sharing these images. And at this point, they start getting messages from social media accounts that have Russian names that are telling the friend group that we have him in the back of our car. And we're going to hurt him. And they start lodging homophobic slurs. They start telling all this stuff. Now, Alex's dad is like, as soon as I saw that, I knew it. Mm-hmm. They didn't have my son. Lisa, his mother's like, they did not have my son. I knew these were disgusting trolls. And it was mm-hmm. not, that's not where my son was. Mm-hmm. But his friends are like believing everything. They're 15 to 18 years old. Like, they're just like, they're contacting the police and they find out the police are able to look for the IP address of these messages and they're able to find that he does not have them. But keep in mind, like, this is pretty quick. At 9:00, the police are like, we're not sending out a missing persons note for this kid. Like, he just hasn't mm-hmm. come back. Maybe he's run off. Maybe he'll be back by the evening. It's not a code red for them, but all of his friends and his parents know something is not right. In fact, mm-hmm. his brother loves Alex. He finds out that his brother is missing from the Facebook post. What? Everything is happening very fast. Well, he's not in town. He wouldn't know where Alex is. So he's like scrolling on Facebook and he sees one of his brother's friends post about his brother missing. And so he's like, what's going on? What's happening? And it's at this point that Georgia knows Matt's number, or she gets the number from someone at school who knows Matt. And so she's able to contact Matt and she goes, Matt, we know you're with Alex. You were the last person to see him. Mm-hmm. Where is he? This is 11:00 at night that night. Matt God, I love Friends. I love Friends. Mm-hmm. Matt is like, oh, yeah, I was with him earlier, but I dropped him off at Holmes Chapel at 6 o'clock, which timeline-wise just doesn't make sense. If he picks him up at 6:45 and drops him off, which is their train station,
yeah,
he's dropped him off around 6. That doesn't actually make sense. But he says he's going to Manchester with some friends and that he hasn't seen him since. And all of his friends are at Lisa's house. Like, all of his friends are there. He mm-hmm. would not be going to meet anyone. And so George is like, did he mention any names of the people he's going to meet up with in Manchester? Mm-hmm. And Matt's like, no. And he's like, but I'm at the pub. Like, I can come out and help you look or something. And it's at midnight that night that they call another one of their friends who's at home. And she recalls seeing that story that he posted earlier. And so they're trying to figure out the location and the blurry background. Like, these girls are like following his timeline through mm-hmm. social media, and they're getting as many answers as possible. At the same time, she's also looking up the train schedule and the arrival times for Holmes Chapel. Mm-hmm. So these girls know when the last train back to Holmes Chapel is from Manchester. So all the girls go to the train station and they wait for the last train to come in, and Alex does not come off the train.
Yeah.
But these girls are following every single thread. They're trying to find their best friend.
These are good friends.
They know something is wrong. They're incredible, and they take it seriously because they know if he's not with them, something's wrong. So his friends are now all calling Matt, asking him for answers, being like, we know you were with him. Where is he? What's going on? Lisa then calls Matt Mason. She's trying to get a hold of him. He does not pick up the phone. She texts him, if you don't pick up, I'm going to call the police. Well, he calls her right away. Oh. And she asks, where is my son? Tell me. And then he kept up with his story that he dropped him off at Holmes Chapel. At Holmes Chapel. Again, he offers to help their friends look, but Lisa knew he knew what happened, mm-hmm. so she calls the police. That night, the police contact Matt, being like, hey, this is the police.
Hi, the Cheshire police.
It's the police. Please call us about your friend Alex Rhodes. But Lisa knew. She knew. The kids all go home. It's late at night. Lisa talks about how she can't sleep. She doesn't know where her son is. There's no rest for her. The next morning at 7:40 in the morning, the body of Alex Rhoda is found near a field. It is found by garbage collectors. Oh. They see he has blunt force trauma to his head. He was hit in his head and his body at least 15 times with a wrench. His poor father had to go and ID them. And it's just so heartbreaking to see this family talk about the loss of this wonderful, wonderful child. And his dad returned saying it didn't even look like him.
Oh.
And he had to look at his feet to identify his son.
Oh my God.
They inform the parents, obviously, but his friends don't know yet. And so his friends are called to the police station and they think they're going to give more information. All of this stuff that they collected about their friend. The police, meanwhile, have called all of the girls' parents and told them what happened and instructed them not to tell the girls until they were in police custody. And they were told, and they are heartbroken at the loss of their friend Alex. It's very quick that they know the last person he was with. It's very quick that they suspect Matt Mason mm-hmm. of murder. And so the police go to pick him up. Now, in the UK, you do not get stopped by police. That's not a customary thing. In the UK, when you are, the way you get a ticket for driving or whatever is there's videos everywhere or there's scanners and they mail you your ticket. You're very seldom pulled over unless for extraordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. At least when I was there, that was the situation. So they do a very unusual thing, but a necessary thing where they have to park the car and surround his vehicle until he gets out.
Mm.
They're demanding him get out of the car. Matt Mason is stuck in his car and he does not move. He continues to not move. Now, this is a moment where I think it's important to note, in the UK, it is illegal for you to carry any sort of handgun. Mm-hmm. In certain situations, you can carry a rifle, or you can have a rifle if you are a farmer or things like that. Now, to be clear, Matt does not have that, but I just wanted to highlight that this situation feels so different to me than in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Because if that was the case, I think there would be an assumption that this young person had a gun. Mm. Where in the U.K., there is this element of, like, this person does not have a gun.
Yeah.
So the police are able to surround him. This kid has nothing to do but just sit in the car.
Right.
The police open the window. They break the window. They pull him out. He has dried blood on his hands. They find in the trunk of his car, they find the weapon, the wrench he used, and they find Alex's coat in the trunk of the car. Matt immediately starts to argue it was self-defense, which is disgusting. But at the trial, that is what he goes with, is that it was self-defense,
right,
that Alex had attacked him first. What they believe happened is that Alex was on his knees and the wrench hit him. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there was any sort of attempt at a sexual encounter that made Alex more vulnerable or things like that. I don't know. They never disclosed that. No one knows.
Matt knows.
At the trial, admitted to having sex with Alex and that he thought it was wrong. And he said he didn't believe that his friends and family would accept him for his attraction to boys, to men, to boys. Alex was 15.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't. He was underage. And I think, too, his family is very, and friends are very conscientious that Matt groomed Alex. Mm-hmm. This older boy groomed this 15-year-old kid who was underage and could not legally consent to this type of relationship. His family attended every single minute of that trial. And his brother, he talks about how he wanted to know every single moment that his brother went through, and that it was his duty to be there as his brother, to be there for every second, to hear every piece of information. What's really crazy is at the trial, I know it's, that part gives me chills because he was also so, like, it was awful, but I owed it to my brother to do that.
And I'm like, I got news for you. Your brother loved you. I don't think he wanted feel any of that.
I think when you lose someone, I know people who have lost family members in this specific way. I know that when you go to trial, there's a sense that maybe it can provide closure. Not even that, but also you have to show up because there's not much else you can show up for your family in the future. Yeah. Like, there is this.
No, I understand it. I'm just like,
it's heartbreaking
that when someone is dead, they want the best for you still. Yeah. Like, take care of yourself.
What's crazy about the trial is that Matt, when he was first testifying, he was speaking in a way like he was not totally competent. Like, his family say that he starts speaking sort of like Forrest Gump. In some way, he's of, like, slower mind or not able to, like.
But was he doing that, like, as a put on?
Yeah. He was trying to
seem dumb so that they'd
to
be
seem
like
he was incompetent, so that he can't withstand trial. Like, they were trying, he was like trying everything. In fact, the prosecutors had to go through Matt's social media to see if he actually sounded like that.
Because
think
like
about
that.
This. I mean, yes, the jury, the judge, like, they're just meeting this person who's presenting himself for the first time. Like, they don't know him from Adam. I'm sorry, Adam, I don't want to, but they don't know him from Steve. They don't know him from any other guy. I don't want to offend any Adams or Steves. But it's like, they don't know him, and so he can only present. And I think we see this in trials oftentimes, is people dress differently. People behave differently. They're on their best behavior. They're not going to, of course, be their worst selves. But they had to prove, based on his social media videos, that he didn't fucking talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
What's crazy is in trial, I keep saying what's crazy, but also in the trial, they discover a week before Alex was killed, was murdered in cold blood, Matt did internet searches for phrases like, what would happen if you kicked someone down the stairs? Everyday poison. And the mysteries of Cheshire unsolved deaths of missing people. Now, his excuse was he was considering self-harm And that's why these searches happen.
So he was going to throw himself down the stairs?
Fuck you, dude. Fuck you. Now, after he killed Alex, he knew that he had to create a sort of alibi. So afterwards, he went to a local pub to have a pint with his friends, which is just vile.
So gross.
In fact, he went to two fucking pubs. He took a photo at one of them and the idea to be an alibi. And then afterwards, he went back to the field to see if Alex was there. There are reports, or there's, I think someone had mentioned that Matt said when he hit Alex, he believes that he might have been still breathing when he left the scene. But he returned to the scene of the crime and Alex was gone, as in dead. But Alex was not breathing. And so he tried to drag Alex to his car. And so he dragged his body to the side of the road, which is where he's eventually found. And he tried to get him in his car, but Alex is a big guy. And he could not drag him into the car. And what's interesting is that there is someone, his car was parked on the side of the road. Obviously, this was not, he was not caught in the moment, but a car was driving nearby and it took a photo of his car at the area. Just somebody driving by going, oh, we should take a photo of this. And they were able to locate this, which again, I think just puts him there at the crime. So there's no question, obviously, that it's him. But again, in court cases, every piece of evidence will help put this guy mm-hmm. away. The jury deliberated for a couple of days, which is a couple of days longer. But fortunately, it was a guilty verdict. Mm-hmm. He had groomed Alex. He received life in prison, which is to say he has to serve at least 28 years before he is eligible for parole. Matt did appeal the decision, and his sentence was lowered 2 years, so he's still there for 26 years. His family talks about if social media wasn't available, this would not have happened. Matt had moved on. Matt graduated. Matt was no longer at school. He didn't have any ability to contact Alex mm-hmm. unless it was for social media. Lisa, Alex's mother, talks about how her son was able to be so free in himself, in his own person. Mm-hmm. And he was killed by someone who could not be. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how they know that Alex was happy and was who he was without apologies. And I think that gives them comfort. Obviously, there's so much anger that it's someone who couldn't snuffed his life out. Mm-hmm. In a way that is so vile. His dad talks about how his son, he's heartbroken that his son has missed so much of his life because his life was just beginning. And he talked about how, I guess in the trial, Matt had talked about how they didn't kiss or there was no kissing. And his father... And Alex's father talks about how his heart breaks because his son didn't get a chance at a loving relationship, you know, mm-hmm. to feel the love of someone who was unapologetic in their love for mm-hmm. him because that's what he deserved. Mm-hmm. He also said, oh, this makes me so sad, but he said, a man couldn't wish for a better son. And that's the story of Alex Rhoda. May he rest
so
in peace.
So sad. Ugh. So sad.
And also, I'm heartbroken for his friends mm-hmm. and his family and everyone who loved him.
Yeah, that is really sad.
Oh,
don't let your kids get online. Goodbye.
Avoid it. Avoid like the fucking plague that it is. Yeah. It's terrible. All right. Well,
read a book.
This was a sad one.
Read a book.
Read a book.
Stay inside.
Stay inside. Don't leave the house.
That's our suggestion. Take it.
If you learn one thing from our podcast, don't do anything that would be scary.
Don't do a thing.
Honestly, the people who get in trouble are people who do stuff.
We've noticed a pattern. It would be wrong of us not to share it. Irresponsible, yeah, even.
It's honestly cruel, and we could be convicted of manslaughter.
Stay
if we
home.
Didn't give you that advice. Stay
read a
home,
book. Wear read gloves if you don't want to get a paper cut.
Be a hand model. Goodbye.
Bye, dear readers.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.